Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hey, it's Carolyn Tim.
And we have something new and exciting for you.
Everything you love about Bloomberg Radio is now in your car.
The new Bloomberg Business app, now featuring Apple CarPlay and Android Auto.
Listen to your favorite Bloomberg radio stations anytime.
Plus, every Bloomberg podcast, the latest news and more, all at the click of a button.
It's free and simple to use. Just download the Bloomberg Business app on your smartphone and connect your phone to your car.
The Bloomberg Business app, now with Apple CarPlay and Android Auto features. Download it free in the Apple App Store or on Google Play.
Presented by our sponsor, Interactive Brokers.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Absorb light. I can see it. And Kamala.
Who's Kamala?
Hi.
She can turn light into physical matter, which I have never heard of.
I could totally show you.
No!
So the question that I have for you, Jennifer, is if you're going to go spend, how much does it cost to go to a movie now? 18 bucks?
Something like that.
Something like, are you going to go spend 18 bucks to see that movie?
Not sure.
Not sure? Okay. I think, well, that's the big question, right? That's an excerpt from the preview of the 33rd film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, aka MCU for those in the know, which is not me. It hits theaters today. It's aptly named The Marvels. I'm not in the know. Joel Weber just looked at me like I was, you know, a superhero.
I thought, you know, you seem like you should know.
I told Jennifer this story earlier, Joel. At the beginning of the pandemic, back in like March of 2020, my wife and I were like, oh, let's watch all the Marvel movies.
How far did you make it?
We made it through two of them. And then we just started watching.
You got that 30 more to go. Yeah. So you still got time. It's cool.
Okay. So Thomas Buckley's got a great.
Disney would appreciate your business. So,
it doesn't matter. I pay for Disney Plus regardless, right? As long as there's Bluey there, we're paying for it. So.
Well, you got that. You got a whole bunch of other Marvel movies. And ever since Disney acquired Marvel more than a decade ago, they have just turned Marvel into a blockbuster powerhouse.
That voice you're hearing, by the way, is none other than Joel Weber. He's editor of Bloomberg Business Week by day, but by night, he's a superhero.
Sure.
DC or Marvel superhero? That's the question.
It would be a Marvel one.
Okay. We also have joining us Jim Ellis. He's assistant managing editor for Bloomberg Business Week. He edited Thomas Buckley's story in the current issue of Bloomberg Business Week. Available on newsstands now, online at the Bloomberg Terminal, and of course at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Joel, I'm sorry. Now you can talk.
Okay. So great acquisition. In 2009, Disney spent $4 billion. The catalog, the MCU universe that has transpired from this Marvel acquisition generated close to $30 billion at the box office. All those movies that you haven't watched are adored by legions of
some
fans.
Some of them I saw in theaters.
Okay. Well, it's starting to get to a point where these movies aren't having quite as big of a success or any success that they've previously had. So more muted, fans may be getting a little tired of that superhero genre, and now we have yet another movie coming out this weekend, Jim Ellis, The Marvels by Marvel by Disney. How's The Marvels going to do?
Wait, We're working on getting. There's Jim Ellis. Sorry, Jim. Sorry, just go start over one more time. We had trouble getting your signal.
How's the Marvels gonna do, Jim?
Most likely, the Marvels will probably do about half the opening weekend business that the previous installment of this franchise did. You know, that is a disappointment, obviously, because this is an extremely expensive movie to make. You know, this was probably within $150 to $200 million movie. And the big question for Marvel right now is, given the cost of all these films that they've made in the MCU, can they actually start keeping the profits, you know, running on these new installments, even though fewer people are going to theaters? I mean, they've already had a disappointment earlier this year with the latest installment of the Ant-Man franchise. That movie did not make its production cost back. And so that's sort of a warning here. I mean, there's been a lot of content, a lot of MCU content out there. There's a lot of Disney content out, but the MCU content there's a lot of it. A lot of people say, well, you know, there are a lot of movies, I'll sit down and watch them. Like you, Tom, let's say like, oh, I'm gonna get to that. The issue though is that there's so much of it that you get sort of lost in it. We took a look at just how much MCU content was out there. We figured it out, we clocked it out by the minutes that are available right now. And you can do 31 days and 52 minutes of nonstop watching of MCU content. That includes the movies, the television shows that they've made. They've done a bunch of specials, and they've got a lot of animated content that's been coming up since 2009. So it's an amazing amount of just stuff, of Marvel stuff that's out there. And so we're hitting the point where a lot of people are saying, well, maybe I've had enough.
Look at your life. Look at your choices, Tim. You could spend 31 days and 50 minutes nonstop.
Let us know how that works out for you.
I might be there. I'll let you know in 33 days.
But you know, getting back to where Disney stands in all of this, I mean, if one were writing the screenplay of let's buy a blockbuster franchise and produce a lot of movies out of it, we would be getting to the point where the profits are starting to fall off. And surely the audience saw this coming. I mean, what's Disney's plan here? Have they prepared for it? Is this something they're communicating to investors? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, I mean, what they're saying now is that they're going to reduce, you know, both the number of movies that Marvel produces, and also they're going to actually cut down on the amount of money that's spent on a per film basis. Now, Wall Street likes that, but the worrisome part of that is that what's left in that intellectual property trove that, you know, is Marvel, the comic book company that they bought and basically have mined successfully for all this time. But what characters are left if you're not doing sequels? Because they're saying also they're not going to do as many sequels. Then, you know, are you going to have to move to the sort of third tier or fourth tier hero? Or are you really going to have to go and look for different types of people who know how to, you know, sort of produce this type of film and our TV shows? I mean, they're already saying now that they're going to go out and hire, showrunners who are used to producing, you know, regular sort of network and streaming shows, not just in-house at Disney. They're sort of recognizing that they need more juice to get consumers interested. I mean, they've gotten a lot of flack this past year over things like, She-Hulk, law, you know, Attorney at Law, and shows like that, that have sort of stretched the franchise in a way that, you know, a lot of people didn't connect to. So it's for every Loki that a lot of people have gotten excited about, there are an awful lot of She-Hulks and other things that people say like, I don't really feel it. Even something like Secret Invasion, that was a series that they had earlier this year that I personally liked a lot, but I seem to have been in the minority on that. I mean, a lot of people are just saying, you know, it's so much. There's so much content and there's so many characters and there's so many interconnections, which was good at the beginning, but now it can be a little daunting, particularly if you want to start watching the MCU, because who's going to go back and say, I'll go back and look at the previous 32 movies before I watch this?
Well, Tim,
maybe that was my was my problem, Jim. Maybe I shouldn't have done that.
Jim, we'll get back to your...
There's like a weird order, too. You have to...
Well,
we had to get the order.
Is it
online.
Weird or is actually just the order, Jim? You know, like there are rules to this
there
stuff.
There were prequels and sequels.
It's true.
And, yeah, that's what and made it confusing
side stories,
to me. So
yeah,
there were true. Ones that came out more
yeah,
recently.
Clearly you haven't watched Star Wars with. Also on Disney Plus. Okay, so, Jim, we'll get back to your your personal taste in movies momentarily. But I do want to also just put out there, Jim, this is not just a test of Marvel. It's actually a test of the superhero genre because Marvel, which is, you know, we've seen the treasure trove that is its archive. It's minted, you know, billions for Disney. DC has also an immense library, but we haven't seen as many of those movies on the big screen, and they're actively working on it.
They're actively working on it, and they've hired some, you know, sort of big talent to in the superhero world, put it that way. They've hired the director who did a bunch of the X-Men films. They've, they're looking to come up with their own universe of interconnected characters. However, you know, they have also been victims to this sort of cooling of enthusiasm for superheroes. I mean, this past year. They had Shazam, Fury of the Gods, they had The Flash, they had the Blue Beetle. All of those are DC comic characters. All of those movies disappointed at the box office. And, you know, it sort of goes into this theme that maybe we've had too much, or have we had too much, or are the stories just not that great? The test of that, at least for DC, is going to come in December when Aquaman, which is... also a sequel, you know, to their Aquaman movie that came out in 2018.
Which was a huge success.
That was a huge success. Then that brought in $1.1 billion, you know, at the box office. And so now we're going to see if this sequel to that can do as well, or sort of, and factoring in that this is a very different environment now, where people are still not back to normal going to theaters. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, the profits that you can make from streaming world on this aren't what you can do on a real big theatrical hit.
Where does CGI come into this, and what did we learn in the story about CGI?
Well, we learned that a lot of a lot of critics and a lot of the for want of a better word, you know, MCU fanboys sort of think that the CGI has gotten a little either sloppy, or it's just not of the quality that we saw in some of the early movies.
I thought they
movies.
Were documentaries.
A lot of complaints about some of the CGI in some of the television shows, like a She-Hulk, and also that the last movie, Quantumania, which was earlier this year, a lot of people thought that that came across as sort of video game-ish and not movie-ish. And the thing is that, let's face it, a lot of these movies are filmed in front of green screens the same way that a video game would be, but they're not supposed to look that way. So I don't know if that's something that a lot of average moviegoers think about, but it seems to be quite a lot of people who are the sort of the influencers and also the people who write reviews. They care quite a lot about that. And so that's something that Disney is going to have to think more about, particularly when they've got a visual effects team that's stretched across so many platforms. You know, it's not just theatrical movies. It's having to do things for the Disney Plus streaming service, as well as, you know, they're putting things with, you know, movies and specials inside their theme parks. So there's a lot of work going on there, but, you know, with a limited number of people.
All right, let's bring it back to the Marvels, since that is the movie coming out now. Jennifer Ryan, the Marvels is coming. This is a sequel to Captain Marvel, which we're throwing around billions. It made $1 billion at the box office in 2019. Brie Larson, female lead. You going?
I think I saw that one.
No?
I am not.
She's not?
I think I saw that one.
Tim?
Yeah,
are you going?
Not, I'm not going.
I am going tomorrow night.
See, that was what I was waiting for. Jim Ellis loves the movies.
I already have my tickets.
He's going.
And I will be able to say whether it was it's better or worse. One of the things that I'm surprised that as this this universe expands, I mean, a lot of the things that you're seeing now in those movies, you know, like this one is much more of a, it'll be a female empowerment movie, obviously a female hero, but also in this case, three female heroes in the movie. Also, mixed generation, very young teens, plus some, you know, sort of older actresses. And I mean, these are things that were not even issues at the beginning with an Iron Man, which the stories were much more traditional comic book hero stories. And now we've gotten more and more into seeing the lives of people on screen. Mm-hmm. And I'm not certain that works as well unless you're Spider-Man.
You know what works though? Man eating kittens with tentacles for tongues.
That's the Marvels tonight.
Exactly. So, okay. So Jim, we await a full report.
Yeah. Please do come back next week, Jim, and let us know how the movie was. That Marvel fan you were listening to is Jim Ellis, assistant managing editor for Bloomberg Business Week. Also with us, Joel Weber. How many of the 33 movies have you seen, Joel?
Not all 33, okay. But I would say a lot of them.
Okay. All right. Well, you still got time. You got to spend the weekend doing
Disney
it.
Plus, yeah.
Check out the story.
31 days later.
Check out the story. It's in the current issue of Bloomberg Business Week on newsstands now.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Jennifer, hard to believe it, but Thanksgiving is less than 2 weeks away. Are you going to be here for Thanksgiving?
I am.
Yeah?
And I'm not doing any cooking.
I was just going to ask. You knew where I was going. We're going to go visit our in-laws in, where am I going? I'm going to Cincinnati.
I'm going to Connecticut.
Oh, okay. Well, you get to drive. I have to fly. So, yeah, I kind of envy that. It's the worst time of year to fly. These figures that I'm going to cite right now are dated because did you know that on Friday, every Friday, the USDA comes out with a Turkey National Retail Report? And when I did the research for this segment, the retail report I was looking at was from Friday, November 3rd, and it showed no change in the price of a turkey between last year and this year. And then I pull it up again right now, and now I have the November 10th one up, and it shows that we actually are seeing turkeys a little bit more expensive this year than last year.
Interesting. Yeah. I had thought there was a glut. That's something I had heard, but
I know someone. I know someone who has been talking turkey for more than 20 years. We love having him join the show because it's kind of a Thanksgiving tradition to check in with him. The CEO of the turkey company Butterball, Jay Jandrin, is with us right now. He joins us on Zoom from Butterball headquarters in Garner, North Carolina. So Jay, good to have you back with us. What are we getting wrong when it comes to the way we're looking at these turkey prices that come from the USDA here?
Well, we really have to get through the entire holiday selling season to get a true picture of that. And the reason for that is you've got a lot of heavy discounting and feature activity from the retailers during the holiday. So it's really a matter of timing, exactly when they pull the data. And once you get through the entire holiday, so you see exactly what sold and at what prices to get a real accurate picture. But overall, you'll see pricing is going to be about the same as it was last year.
How closely do you follow these reports from the USDA?
We do pay attention to those. And of course, those are things that we look at when we evaluate the holiday, what the sell-through is like, what the consumers purchased, what our retailers are telling us as far as their overall sales. So it goes into kind of a bigger picture for us to really look at next year and how we're going to approach next year's holiday season.
I wondered if you could give us a little bit of insight in what retailers are telling you. I mean, we had our colleagues talking a little while ago, and one of them was mentioning that at one point he saw some free turkeys floating around some retailers, and I couldn't get my head around that. But I mean, is that something that you're seeing at all?
You know, each retailer has their own strategy on how they go about that. And some do give away turkeys with a certain amount of sale in the basket, some heavily discounted. It's just really all over the board. And they're all, you know, looking for ways to help get that shopper into the door. So they'll try things new each year to see what works for them. Or sometimes if they feel the strategy is working for them, whatever that strategy is for their stores, they'll stick with it. So it's all over the board. You know, we don't even know really up until the time that the prices are released as well on what they're going to be. So we're certainly paying attention to those prices and those retails as well.
So how important is Thanksgiving to your business? I mean, give us numbers here. Just like how many, you know, what percentage of sales do you do during the month of November versus year round?
Well, it's certainly a big part of our business, but it's not all of our business. We have over $1 billion in sales, and this represents a good portion of that. But what, you know,
like
we 50% really look at is within the holiday. I'm sorry?
Over 50%?
No, much less than 50%. But what we look at is particularly is how we sell versus other brands and other products in the case during that period of time. And one of the important facts that we look at is, or the measures we look at is, the Butterballs, every three turkeys sold in the retail outlets is a Butterball. So that's the number we pay real close attention to, what that market share is every year, how it goes up or down, and how it adjusts throughout each holiday season.
So looking away from the holidays, I mean, just to help us get a better sense of how your business is operating, where's the big sources of demand for the rest of the year?
Well, it really comes in our CPG products, our consumer packaged goods, maybe in our ground turkey products that we sell throughout the year. We also do a lot of business in food service as well. So that's a big portion of our business. May go to restaurant chains or to food service distributors who are selling to mom and pop restaurants. And then we have a portion of our business that's international as well. So it's pretty well diversified.
Well, one of the reasons we like having you on around this time of year is not just to prepare us for cooking Thanksgiving turkeys, but also because you guys do a survey each year when it comes to understanding consumers for the holidays. The surveys have been a little interesting over the last few years because of the pandemic, but it seems like a theme this year in the data that you found at Butterball, we're sort of seeing this return to pre-pandemic activity. Talk to us a little bit about what you found.
We are, and that's great news. Yeah, everyone is finally kind of over the COVID stuff, and celebrations are back to what they were pre-COVID, which is great. You've got more people in households now celebrating together, an opportunity for friends and family to get together, which is fantastic. So yeah, we're really happy to see that those levels come back. And the good news for us is that turkey will be at the center of the table as it has been year in and year out. So turkey sales are expected to be very good this year. People don't break too much from tradition. I mean, they're gonna celebrate like they did in the past, and that means the turkey will be on the table for sure.
Yeah, that's one thing I wanted to ask you, is how stable is turkey as a centerpiece of Thanksgiving?
It is stable. It varies very little year in and year out. We were really curious to see what would happen during COVID as well. And what we found there is that sales were very, very good. It was just a little bit different. We had less larger size turkeys sold and more smaller because the gatherings were smaller because people couldn't travel and get together like they would otherwise. This year, we're seeing more people at the table. So we're expecting you'll probably see a few more sales of larger turkeys this year.
How early do you have to plan for to anticipate demand? I mean, it seems like you have to plan for this a year ahead of time.
Well, that's exactly right. As soon as this holiday is done, we're producing product for the next holiday season. So it is a year-round production cycle for us. And it gets a little tricky, you know, to try to understand what our retailers are going to be looking for each year. We spend a lot of time talking with our customers and sharing the information that we have from the holidays, so they have a good expectation of what they think they need for the next year as well. So it really begins in earnest. As soon as the Thanksgiving meal is over, we're producing more product and talking to our customers for next year's holiday already.
All right, Jay, we got 20 seconds. Are you answering any of the phones at the Turkey Talk line this year?
No, I won't. I'm going to leave that to the experts. Those folks certainly know what they're doing, and I'm going to let them do that. But I did get a chance to visit with some of them last week at an event we had in New York City with a partnership with Bumble for Friends that we did. And we had some of our top line hosts there, and it was a
very
great
cool
opportunity to share our stories.
Jay, always great to chat with you. Jay Jandran, Chief Executive Officer, President of Butterball, joining us right here on Bloomberg Business Week from Garner, North Carolina. Happy Thanksgiving, Jay. You're listening to Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the
Bloomberg Business app and YouTube.
You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, Bitcoin has just been on a tear. I'm actually pulling it up right now because, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, it trades 24/7. It's up for the last 5 days in a row. It's right now trading at $37,380, its highest since May of 2022. And our next guest actually thinks that Bitcoin still has more room to run, betting it'll increase 50% next year. John Wu is president at Avalabs. The company is developing the blockchain Project Avalanche, which it calls the, quote, fastest smart contracts platform in the blockchain industry, and touts it as, quote, fast, low cost, and eco-friendly. John joins us now for our weekly look at crypto right here in the Interactive Brokers studio. So, John, before we get to the crypto market and your calls, I do want to touch on the Avalabs news that we got this week. Our own Bloomberg News team here reporting that Ava cut jobs by 12% this week in a restructuring. We should note it's just the latest layoffs to hit the cryptocurrency sector. What can you tell us about this restructuring?
Well, that's right, Tim. And, you know, that day was probably the toughest day in my 4 years at Ava Labs. But in the last 4+ years, we've gone from 10 people to 270 before this 12%. And the world has changed. Like any fast-growing business, you have to assess where the market is, what kind of products you're building, and analyze it, and then make the necessary changes. So it was very tough. I called some of those people my friends, but it was necessary. And the team is leaner, and I've got 200 and almost 40 people still that I have to think about.
So is this it for cuts
yes,
for the next year or so?
It was a one-time thing. That's it.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess one thing, though, if you could just pull back and talk a little bit about the market for Bitcoin so far this year. I mean, there's just been this resurgence. Is that going to continue? Are we going to see a Bitcoin ETF?
Oh, I mean, that is obviously the rage. I mean, so first, the surge in the Bitcoin prices. Keep in mind, I'm an operator, but I used to be a fund manager, so I keep a lot of perspectives in mind. It was really two things. Recently, you've had call it uninverting of the yield curve from a macro perspective. You had also announced that there'll be less supply in treasury auction sales. So that created a backdrop from a macro perspective that was very positive for risk assets and crypto included in that. But on a micro perspective, you had, I think you called it on your own show, exuberance for these ETF potentials. I think we're getting closer to the reality of one of those. And reality is, I think a lot of these institutional managers are trying to get ahead in anticipation of that.
How are they doing that? Just by buying Bitcoin? Or, I mean, how do you get ahead of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think they are buying. Well, if you look at the volumes, where they're coming from, if you are doing it on centralized exchanges like a Coinbase, or are you doing in a decentralized exchange, which is on-chain? Typically, the crossover investors, the institutional hedge fund types, they do it on-chain. So you can do it either through Coinbase, or you can do it through proxies. Those are basically Grayscale's product. Then you also have other proxy products out there, trusts like that. And you have certain stocks that you can buy it. So if you look at that, you would say that it was more crossover traditional people getting ahead of the ETF announcement.
How much do you think Grayscale is spending on marketing? Because you cannot go into an airport in the New York City area or the Washington, D.C. area and not see an ad for GBTC.
Listen, when you have $30 billion in assets and you charge what they charge, you have decent, you know, marketing budget.
And do you think they're also doing marketing to get ahead of that, to gin up interest ahead of a spot Bitcoin ETF?
They've been very consistent in their marketing even before this. You know, part of their job is also to proselytize asset managers, and they've been very good at it. I know those guys well. They've been doing it for more than 5-6 years.
One thing, just to go back to the, you know, the outlook here. I mean, you mentioned this link between a risk on appetite and demand. What's the chance that that risk on appetite is going to continue into next year? I mean, we've certainly got a lot of macro feedback that's not going to be the case.
Yeah, I mean, that is, everything is likely, and it's a volatile asset class, so anything can happen in the short term. But if you look at it over the course of the year, Bitcoin is actually a lot better than most tech stocks. It's up something like 200 to 300, somewhere between 200 and 300%. Literally 200 or 300%. You can't even tell you exactly unless you're really studying it day to day. So actually, over the longer period of time, it's still doing relatively well. Can it go backwards? Sure. And I wouldn't even be surprised. People have bought in anticipation of the news and then sell it on the news, so to speak, of an ETF release. But just think about it. BlackRock has $10 trillion in assets. So, you know, if 1% of their distribution picks up on this, that's, you know, $100 billion. $100 billion, you know, the Bitcoin ETF, Bitcoin market cap, I think, is about 700-ish. So it's like 14% increased demand. And that's only 1% of just BlackRock. You have Fidelity, you have other big players involved. So over time, it'll still continue to have positive inflows.
Okay. You know, and then just to continue on with the sort of sentiment around the market at this point, can you explain a little bit about how the implosion of FTX is landing in terms of getting new customers in, people sticking with the asset class?
Well, obviously, when it happened, the FTX scenario, it was literally about a year ago. Mm-hmm. Everything changed. The market structure of the asset class really deteriorated. A lot of players left the system. I think what's good right now, a year later after the trial, is that people are saying, okay, it's almost there where we can put this chapter behind us and move forward. So I think the fact that we can put this chapter, or closer to putting this chapter behind us, we removed a lot of bad actors, is all viewed positive going forward.
I saw last week, I believe it was last week or the week before, Jennifer, correct me if I'm wrong if you know this, that we saw another person accused of being a bad actor in the crypto space by the Southern District of New York. Like, this was an actual, you know, complaint. Where are we in weeding everybody out?
I think we're farther along than people realize. There are bad actors. I mean, this place has, I've been in this space for a while. This space has been a petri dish of genius experimentation and frauds and scams, unfortunately. You know, regulatory rules are different in every part of the world, and they're frankly uncertain. So it allows the bad actors to come in and try to take advantage of things. But what is happening with this ETF potential, as well as, again, I'm an operator. Ava Labs is actually a software services company helping people build on Avalanche. The partnerships and the business development relationships we're building with professionals tells me professionals are coming into the space. There's new leadership coming. And it's frankly nice to see a blend of great technologists working with domain experts, whether that be traditional finance or the stuff we're working on in Asia with gaming companies or loyalty rewards programs.
Yeah, I mean, that's my next question for you, isn't it? It's the industry developing and more professionals coming in. What's sort of the vision in terms of pursuing that with corporate partnerships?
So the vision for Ava Labs, again, software service, just like Red Hat was for Linux, is to help people deploy things on top of Avalanche, create real business use cases for traditional companies as well as crypto native companies. So giving them product market fit, getting them business use cases. Stablecoins was a perfect example. I think that is the real first thing in blockchain or Web3, if you will, that has established product market fit. Brevin Howard's research said there was over $11 trillion on-chain settlement in stablecoins in last year. That's the same volume, almost the same volume as Visa over the course of a year. So My prediction, you know, for next year, 2024, is you're going to have the same volume as both Visa and MasterCard in terms of stablecoin settlements.
You guys profitable over at Ava Labs yet?
Ava Labs is a profitable company, yes.
Going public? What's the plan?
We're a little bit away from going public, but we are profitable. It depends, because the accounting rules are a little bit tricky, to be fair, but we are cash flow positive. How about that?
Cash flow positive. Okay. So not profitable, but cash flow positive.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Really appreciate you joining us. John Wu, president of Ava Labs, the company developing the blockchain project Avalanche.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
You drive, stay in prison.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, time's certainly flying on this Friday afternoon. We got about 18 minutes until the close of U.S. equity market trading here in New York. You just heard the numbers from Charlie and Bill, but they are worth repeating. The Dow up more than 1% to reach 34,278. The S&P 500 higher by more than 1.5%, and the NASDAQ higher by a full 2 percentage points. Really eager what our Drive to the Close guest has to think about all this. Rob Hayworth is Senior Investment Strategist at U.S. Bank Asset Management Group. Good to have you with us this afternoon, Rob. What do you make of this rally? The S&P 500 up 8 of the last 9 days. Fed Chair Jay Powell not really successfully throwing water on it yesterday.
No, not quite yet. But I think some of the signs here, especially the strength in the NASDAQ, tells us that the market and investors are still worried about higher interest rates for longer, right? They may be taking Jay Powell a little bit at his word as they're looking for companies that are not going to be reliant on debt market funding for their future growth, and probably looking to companies that have more natural growth embedded within them. We're seeing more of a general rally today, but the leadership certainly speaks to that worry for us.
I mean, one thing I'm wondering is, you know, looking at some of the stocks that are struggling today, like Diageo, you're seeing some price sensitivity start to emerge among U.S. consumers. I mean, what does that sort of tell you for the outlook for, you know, these consumer-facing names to continue to plow ahead strongly?
Yeah, we're very much looking ahead to retail sales next week. I think the consumer remains a major question in all our outlooks, especially after we got consumer credit and the senior loan officer opinion survey this week, which pointed out that, you know, lending is down and there's certainly some question as to what is the resilience left in the consumer after such strong data in Q3, right? Can they maintain it as they have to start paying back student loans and other things? And I think, you know, as we look ahead into some of the big box retailers in coming weeks, that's something we're going to be paying close attention to because the consumer is front and center for what's going to drive the economy in 2024.
I find that it can be just quite difficult to unpack consumer sentiment because if you add to the student loan costs, you've also got massive child care bills that are going to be coming landing on people's doorsteps now that federal funding is dried up there. So there's so much pressure on consumers' wallets, but at the same time, the job market is incredibly healthy. So it's hard to know, do consumers feel rich or do they feel poor?
Right. Yeah, no, that. And the sentiment surveys have made that difficult. Certainly, if we just looked at today's University of Michigan consumer sentiment survey, you'd have to worry about that. But, you know, they may be focused on things other than just what's going on in their pocketbooks, because as you dig into the survey, personal finances were something consumers felt OK about. It was more about the impact of higher borrowing costs and of that inflation could worry them in the future. So I think this is a little bit of a unique environment that we haven't seen in the last two decades in the economy, where we're getting fairly robust wage growth numbers. We're not seeing a lot of layoffs. I mean, the weekly jobless claims remain quite low at 217,000 this last week. So that labor market isn't quite as strong as it was, but it remains fairly strong, and that's giving the consumers some resilience, even if they're not quite happy with where prices have been headed.
But doesn't, Rob, that also make the Fed's job that much harder?
Absolutely, right? And I think that's why we're seeing, and we saw Chair Powell really emphasize holding rates higher for longer and looking harder and longer at the data. I think, as we're seeing it, I mean, they could be on hold well into the middle of next year, depending upon how the economic data unwinds. And there's room to see that, right? We're still working through the adjustment to borrowing costs. I mean, one of the things we look at is what is the average mortgage rate for existing mortgages, right? We know it's 7.5-8% for new mortgages.
And what is it, sub 4%?
I'm sorry?
Is it sub 4%?
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, right. Existing costs are sub 4%. So that gives current homeowners a lot of room to still manage their budget because their housing costs aren't going up quite as quickly as what it costs for new buyers. So I think that means that there's as is always want to be said, monetary policy works with long and variable lags. And I think we're seeing that the variance is longer this time.
Well, I mean, Fed Chair Powell talked about this yesterday, Jennifer, and he's talked about this quite a bit over the last few months. A lot of the people who live in homes where they have 30-year mortgages that are sub 4%, they're not experiencing higher rates the same way that those first-time home buyers are. So like he said yesterday, those people are sort of exempt from that higher rate environment, at least when it comes to housing.
When it comes to housing, indeed. But then think about their car loans, think about their credit card loans and loans for any other kind of activity. Yeah. And like we've already been talking about, their student loans. So they are definitely feeling a pinch, but it's just not in the thing that's got the roof over their heads.
Yeah. What do you think?
And
of
it's
what do you think
not
of
as quick, right?
Yeah. Sorry. Rob, go ahead.
No, we're seeing that in the corporate market as well, right? Where companies that have borrowed money and their average maturities are out 10 years aren't having to come back to market quite as quickly as maybe some smaller companies where the term on their loan is 3 to 5 years. So they're having to bear those new costs a little quicker. And I think we're seeing that play out in the differentials within the equity market as well.
One thing I wanted to do, if I could switch gears a little bit in our chat about the equity market, is to talk about your thoughts on the big rallies that we're seeing in some tech names like Microsoft. I mean, do you think that this is, they look like some crowded trades perhaps. I mean, do you think that this is something that can continue or is this still, we were talking earlier in the show about the shift to greed in the market, or is there still some legs there?
Having lived through a couple of market cycles, I'd say that we're not seeing valuations quite as stretched as we may have historically. And I think the constructive thing is this is being underpinned by earnings and actual growth in sales and revenue. When we think about the push to cloud services, the push for artificial intelligence, the push for software as a service to increase and enhance productivity. So I think the constructive thing is, even though we've seen a tremendous rebound in 2023 after a horrendous 2022, there's still long-term room and long-term growth in these markets because our economy and the innovation in our economy is being driven by technology and the distribution of technology throughout the all sectors in the economy.
Yeah, it's just going to be interesting to see moving forward which of those companies are the ones that get that lion's share, especially, Jennifer, this year. We've seen, the quote-unquote Magnificent Seven really lead the way when it comes to rally on the S&P 500 and in the NASDAQ as well. Rob Hayworth, Senior Investment Strategy Director at U.S. Bank Asset Management, joining us on Zoom from Seattle. A big thank you.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.